Appreciate having me back and giving us another chance to look at God's Word with one another. So I'm in my junior year of high school, and I had college English sixth period with my friend Connor and some other people. Now, Connor and I like to finish our writing ahead of time, because if you finished your writing ahead of time, that meant you didn't have to do anything in class. So we were some of the only students that actually took our writing home and would actually write on it at home and not have to do anything. So we would send our class periods, and we'd be sitting there just watching, I don't know, terrible videos or cracking jokes with each other or playing card games, things like that. So while everyone else was working on essays, we were just doing those things. But sometimes there was this girl that would always sit next to us, and she loved, loved, loved to talk. Normally, she was all happy and bright and smart, except when it came to one thing, her high school boyfriend. She could go from, I had the most amazing time at cheerleader camp this weekend, to, you would not believe what he did to me the other day. And faster than anything I've ever seen, she could transform just like that. And day after day, Connor and I, we listened to these problems. He was drinking in the school parking lot, hanging out with bad people, ignoring her, texting her saying that he'd been in a car wreck when he really hadn't, just so she would pay attention to him, doing some great stuff. One day, Connor goes, are you sure you want to be with him? I mean, every day you complain to us. Her face got real steep. Of course, I love him. Even though every day she was in pain, she just kept on dating him and dating him, off again, on again, stuff like that. It was never healthy, never really good for her, so of course she married him. And now, you could go a lot of places with that story, but hopefully I'm going to take this in a direction you didn't expect. It seemed like every day she was just complaining. This bad guy, the bad he did far, far outweighed the good. And although every now and then he would do something sweet, it was this kind of business of misery being in love with him. He kept doing bad things and bad things and bad things, then he'd do just a little bit of good to keep her. Then he'd do a lot more bad, and right when she was fed up, he'd do a little bit more good. It was this constant exchange of lots of bad and a little good. And it was almost like this terrible business deal that you just couldn't escape from. And hearing that story, I know it's about a relationship built on mutual physical attraction, how you guys look, your dislikes and your likes that you share together, and feelings and stuff like that. But think about this story just in the blandest of terms. Do you have a misery business? Do you have something like she did where, yeah, it hurts me a lot more than it helps me, but every now and then it does something kind of nice for me, and so I'm going to keep it around. Even though the bad far outweighs the good, just sometimes that one good thing is enough for me, so I keep it around. I can't let it go, or I don't know how to, something like that. It could be anything. It could be what we hear, it could be what we watch, what we participate in, really anything that's not giving your faith a non-beneficial exchange. Sometimes something that seems okay, but in reality, it's not good for you. Do you have one of those? I think a lot of us probably do. Tonight, we're going to be looking at an example of a business of misery in the Bible. But I hope you find it as edifying as I did, studying it and worshiping through it. And if you would, please turn with me to 2 Samuel chapter 3. You see, King David had a misery business. And here's how the story goes. If you would, follow along with me, starting in verse 6 of this chapter, and we're going to read through verse 23. But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim, and he made him king over Gilead, and the Asherites, and Jezreel, and Ephraim, and Benjamin, and all of Israel. Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned for 2 years. But the house of Judah followed David. And the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. Abner, the son of Ner, and the servants of David went out and met them at the pool of Gibeon. And they sat down one side of the pool and the other on the other side of the pool. And Abner said to Joab, let the young men arise and let them compete before us. So Joab said, let them arise. Then they arose and passed over by number, 12 for Benjamin, and Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. And each caught his opponent by the head and thrust in his sword in his opponent's side, so they fell down together. Therefore this place was called Helkath Hazarim, which is at Gibeon. And the battle was very fierce that day, and Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. And the three sons of Zeruiah were Joab, Abishai, and Asahel, Now Asahel was as swift of foot as a wild gazelle, and Asahel pursued Abner. And as he went, he turned neither to the right hand, and he did not turn to the left. He kept on following Abner. Then Abner looked behind him and said, "Is that you, Asahel?" And he said, "It is I." Abner said, "Turn aside to your right hand or to your left, and seize one of the young men and take his spoil." But Asahel would not turn aside from following him. Abner again, he said to Asahel, "Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I lift up my face in front of your brother Joab?" But he refused to turn aside. Therefore Abner struck him in the stomach with the butt of his spear, so that the spear came out of his back. And he fell there, and he died where he was. And all who came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died stood still. You see, there's a few things going on here. First of all, we have David gets anointed, but you see, this guy Abner, one of Saul's old commanders, he takes Saul's son Ishbosheth, and he brings him in and anoints him as the king of Israel. Now, obviously, there's some feuding between Israel and Judah going on, so there's a battle that's waged here at Gibeon. And at this battle, the men fight each other, and it's a massive victory for David, even though it doesn't really read like that. But historically speaking, it's a massive, massive victory for David. And the men under David, the men of Judah, are victorious, and these three brothers, Asahel, Joab, and Abishai, start to chase Abner to put an end to Saul's old regime. It makes sense, right? You beat them in battle, well, let's go chase down their commander. We beat their commander, we win. It's pretty simple. Now, Asahel is the fastest of the three brothers. I think it said he's as fast as a wild gazelle. What a compliment, right? Like, what a thing to be remembered by in the Bible, that you're just as fast as a gazelle. And so he naturally gets to Abner first. Abner tells him in verse 21, "Please turn to the right hand or to the left. Take the belongings and just leave me alone. How am I supposed to face Joab, Abner? Or how am I supposed to face Joab, Asahel, if you are here and you are dead?" Asahel doesn't listen, keeps on pursuing him. And in verse 22, Abner pleads one last time, "Please, Asahel, if I were to kill you, how could I ever show my face to your brother? Please, let us be." Asahel doesn't listen, and Abner impales him with his spear. The other two brothers catch up to the spot, and they lament over their fallen brother. And at the end of verse 23, it says that everyone who came there to the grave of Asahel stood still. This feud between Abner and Joab would spark a lifetime of bloodshed and misery for more than just one person. Please turn with me to 2 Samuel chapter 3, starting in verse 6. "While there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. Now Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, 'Why have you gone into my father's concubine?' Then Abner was very angry over the words of Ishbosheth and said, 'Am I a dog's head of Judah? To this day I keep showing steadfast love to you and to the house of Saul, to your father and to his brothers and to his friends, and have not given you into the hand of David. And yet you charge me today with a fault concerning a woman. God do so to Abner and more also if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and set it up over Judah, from Dan to Beersheba.' And Ishbosheth could not answer Abner another word because he feared him." The beginning of verse 6 really talks about war between the house of Saul and the house of David, kind of this feud going on between Ishbosheth and David as he's trying to regain control of the kingdom. And in a real way, this is also a story of Abner again versus Joab. Abner, being the commander of Ishbosheth's army, would be fighting against Joab, the commander of David's army. And there's this clash of Joab and Abner again, just like the battle at Gibeon. Ishbosheth then accuses Abner of laying with his father's concubine. And it doesn't say if this is true or not. Don't really know. Possibly could have been. Some people actually think that it is true, and laying with your father's concubine was a means of trying to take over the kingdom. So they think that Abner might have been trying to remove Ishbosheth from the throne. But this sends Abner just over the rails, completely floors him. And Abner says in verse 8, "Have I not shown steadfast love unto the house of Saul your father? I've been loyal to you, Ishbosheth. I brought you out this kingdom. I anointed you. I fight against David for you. And I haven't given you into his hands, even though I could have, Ishbosheth." But after this accusation, this call out, Abner says, "You know what, Ishbosheth? I'm done. I don't want to work for you anymore. So Abner says in verse, talking about himself, he says, God, do so to Abner and more also, if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah, from Dan to Beersheba. Abner says that not only is he done, he's going to give it all to David. You're not going to have anything left, Ishbosheth. It's all going to be gone. He's tired of it. Abner speaks in a way where he calls upon God, and he says, God, do so to me if I fail to do so upon these things. Isn't that just harrowing and mind-blowing that he would talk to God about himself in that way? How formidable and how daunting it must be to talk like that. In fact, in verse 11, you'll notice that it says, Ishbosheth couldn't answer Abner another word because he feared him, because of the way he was talking about him and his God. Starting in verse 20 of chapter 3, Abner starts to make good on this promise. When Abner came in with 20 men to David at Hebron, David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. And Abner said to David, I will arise and go and will gather all of the Israel to the Lord my king, that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires, O David. So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. Just then the servants of David arrived with Joab from a raid, bringing much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David at Hebron, for he had sent him away, he had gone in peace. When Joab and all the army that was with him came, it was told Joab, Abner the son of Ner has come to visit the king, and he has let him go. He has gone in peace. Then Joab went to the king and said, what have you done? Behold, Abner came to you. Why is it that you have sent him away so that he is gone? You know that Abner the son of Ner came to deceive you, and is to find out your comings and your goings within and without, and to know all that you are doing. You see, for a second, everything seems fine, but you have to remember, this guy killed Joab's brother. Joab, when he finds out that this man came to visit David and David sent him away in peace, he's furious. He blatantly tells the king in verse 24, what have you done? Can you imagine walking up to King David in his court and going, what have you done, David? Joab is furious because Abner killed his brother, and the notion that David would even entertain peace with this guy just sends Joab on the warpath. Starting in verse 26 of chapter 23, it reads, when Joab came out from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the cistern of Sirah, but David did not know about it. And when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him inside into the midst of the gate to speak with him privately. There he struck him in the stomach so that he died, for the blood of Asahel, his brother. Then David said to Joab and to all the people who were with him, tear your clothes and put on sackcloth and mourn before Abner. And King David followed the bier. They buried Abner at Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. This is catastrophic for David. David wanted peace. He did not want war with Saul's house. After all, he had been in Saul's home. He had been in his home, been best friends with his son. I think it's probably fair to say that he knew or at least heard of Ishbosheth in some way when he was with him. He might have even known Abner when he served there as well. David did not want the war to continue, and Joab murders his chance for peace and revenge for his brother. Abner's blood was spilled in cold. Recall back to when Abner said, Asahel, if I kill you now, how can I ever lift up my head to face your brother Joab? He gave Asahel the chance to turn back. He knew even after defending himself from Asahel that when it came time to offer peace to David, he would have to face Joab. Despite that, he still comes to David. Abner still comes wanting peace, and he is repaid with his death after David told him, you will have peace. Joab did not ask David to kill Abner. Joab didn't say, hey, he killed my brother David. Hope it's okay. I'm going to, you know, get rid of Abner for you. And we're still going to have peace. Don't worry. Don't worry, David. But he simply took in revenge and spilled in cold blood. David weeps over this. Did you notice where they buried him? They buried him in Hebron, the city where David lives, the city of kings at this point. They didn't just toss him into a pit outside. They didn't just bury him in the forest. David mourns over him. He tears his clothes. He commands Joab to tear his clothes, saying, look what you've done. Look. David weeps over this. He told a man to go in peace. He effectively gave him his word that there would be peace, and he was killed. He commanded Joab and his own men to tear their clothes. They were not free from the shame of killing him. Verse 32 says, the king lifted up his own voice, and all the people wept. Have you figured out yet that David's misery business was this guy named Joab? You know, he's okay. He's a great military commander. He wins lots of David's battles, but then he ruins his chance for peace. He even insults David by taking in blood a life that was not his to take. He walks up to David in his own court and says, what have you done, King David? If you will, keep exploring this idea with me. Please turn to 2 Samuel chapter 11. You see, one of the next times we see Joab is probably at one of the most famous points in David's life, right when he's laying with Bathsheba. So Bathsheba's husband needs to die. He concocts this plan on how to fix the situation. She will become forfeit if her husband dies, and then I can claim her as my own. David needs someone's life taken. Well, who does David know that's good at murder? Who does David know that's good at deception? Who does David know is loyal to him? Maybe his commander. Maybe Joab. Start with me in verse 14 of chapter 11. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. In the letter, he wrote, set Uriah at the forefront of the hardest fighting, and then draw back from him that he may be struck down and die. And as Joab was besieging the city, he assigned Uriah to the place where he knew there were valiant men. And the men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the servants of David among the people fell. Uriah the Hittite also died. You see, one of the next times we see Joab, he is sending Uriah the Hittite away to die. He's carrying out David's plan. Now, I'm not saying David's innocent here, but I think Joab actually plays a part in it. You know, Joab said, I kind of like that Uriah guy. He's a pretty good soldier. I'm not going to send him, David. Sorry about that. But, you know, Joab's compliant. He's going to do what David wants. Certainly murder does not bother Joab, as we've seen before. And, you know, it's definitely part of King David's folly, but it's just shedding more and more and more blood. And that's going to add up in the long run. And that's going to mean something. Fast forward again to chapter 18 of 2 Samuel. Here we see the next time Joab appears. And the king ordered Joab and Abishai and Ittai, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave orders to all the commanders about Absalom. So the army went out into the field against Israel. And the battle was fought in the forest of Ephraim. And the men of Israel were defeated there by the servants of David. And the loss there was great on this day. 20,000 men. The battle spread over the face of all the country, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword. And Absalom happened to meet the servants of David. Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went under the branches of a great oak tree, and his head caught fast in the oak. And he was suspended between heaven and earth while the mule that was on him went on. And a certain man saw it and told Joab, behold, Joab, I saw this man Absalom hanging in the oak. Joab said to the man who told him, what, you saw him? Why did you not strike him then and there to the ground? I would have been glad to give you 10 pieces of silver and a belt. But the man said to Joab, even if I felt in my hand the weight of 1,000 pieces of silver, I would not reach out my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, for my sake, protect the young man Absalom. On the other hand, if I had dealt treachery against his life and there was nothing hidden from the king, then you yourself would have stood aloof. Joab said, I will not waste time with this like you. And he took 3 javelins in his hand and he thrust them into the heart of Absalom while he was still alive in the oak. And 10 young men, Joab's armor bearers, surrounded Absalom and struck him and killed him. Here we see Joab stabs Absalom and leads men there to kill him, despite David ordering them. Precisely, David and Abishai, his other remaining brother, and Ittai, he tells them, look, when you meet Absalom, deal peacefully. He is my son. Even though he's rebelling against me, even though he's doing these things, that is my son. Deal peacefully with my son. despite David ordering them this, just like he did with Abner. Even David says, don't touch that guy, let him go in peace. Joab does not ask about taking his life. He takes it and doesn't think twice. The men that had seen Absalom before said, Joab says, I would have given you 10 pieces of silver and a belt. The man says, you could have given me 1,000 pieces of silver. I wouldn't have touched him. King told us not to. What does Joab do? He says, I'm not going to waste time with this like you. He says, I'm not going to waste time. And he goes, and he sends 3 javelins into the heart of Absalom. Joab didn't think that way. He took the life of Absalom. And then you know what's sad? Read in the next few verses where they bury him. They did not bury Absalom in the hall of David's family. No, no, no. Verse 17 says, they threw him into a pit in the great forest. I think it must have cooked Joab inside real, real bad when they buried Abner in the city of Kings. I think he must have been pretty upset. And here he is casting David's own son, the one person who deserves to be buried in the city of Kings. And he throws him in a pit in the forest. Joab defies David's orders, even to protect his own son. Joab is, of course, tucked away by David, at least in some sense where he's removed from his position, as the annals of history would suggest. And another is appointed in his place, a man named Amasa, as the leader of David's armies. In 2 Samuel chapter 20, the story of Joab continues. When they were at the great stone that is in Gibeon, Amasa came to meet them. And Amasa is the leader of King David's armies now that Joab has been demoted. But Joab was there wearing a soldier's garment, and over it was a belt with a sword in its sheath fastened on his thigh. And as he went forward, it fell out. And Joab said to Amasa, is it well with you, my brother? And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. But Amasa did not observe the sword that was in Joab's hand. So Joab struck him with it in the stomach and spilled his entrails to the ground without striking a second blow, and he died. Then Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri, and one of Joab's young men took his stand by Amasa's body and said, whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, let him follow Joab. You see, it's not entirely clear as to when Amasa is appointed, but 2 Samuel chapter 19 and verse 13 makes it clear that he was appointed in Joab's place. Joab, in this vacuum of power, he says, oh, I'm so lost. What am I going to do if I'm not the commander of David's armies? So he decides that he wants his old mantle back. And how is he going to do that? Oh, well, I'll just kill the guy that David appointed. So what does he do? He kills Amasa. He finishes Amasa's job, putting down the rebellion that he does, and he returns home to the court of David, acting like he's the hero. He says, you know, Amasa couldn't get this done, but here I have, I'm holding the son of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and I could do it. So Joab is reappointed. He's put back in command of the army again. Joab is no stranger to killing the people, and at this point, it's almost just like another check mark for Joab to make sure he gets back into power. He says, oh, someone needs to die. All right. I'm back in power. It's done. Remember, this man is just going and going and going, trying to gain power. If you will, go with me to 1 Kings chapter 2, starting in verses 5 through 6. This is David's last words to King Solomon before he takes over the kingdom. Moreover, you also know what Joab the son of Zeruiah did to me, how he dealt with the 2 commanders of the armies of Israel, Abner the son of Ner, and Amasa the son of Jether, whom he killed, avenging in time of peace for blood that had been shed in war, and putting the blood of war on the belt around his base and on the sandals of his feet. Act therefore according to your wisdom, but do not let his gray head go down to Sheol in peace. You see, Joab, the man, has served David and conquered many regions in his name. David remembers him for the bloodshed that he caused in times of peace. He remembers him for killing Abner. He remembers him for killing Amasa. David's last words against his own commander are, do not let his gray head go down to Sheol in peace. He tells Solomon to dispose of Joab. He says, look, this guy is ruining my reign. He's killed so many people. He's killed my friends. I've told him there will be peace. He got rid of them. He said, Solomon, look, whatever you do, don't let Joab get a hold of you. Get rid of him. He'll bring you misery. See, the story of Joab comes to an end in verses 29 through 33 of this same chapter of 1 Kings. And when it was told King Solomon, Joab has fled to the tent of the Lord, and he is beside the altar, Solomon sent Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, saying, "Go, strike him down." So Benaiah came to the tent of the Lord and said to him, "The king you commands, come out." But he said, "No, I shall die here." Then Benaiah brought the king word again, saying, "Thus said Joab, and thus he answered me." So the king replied to him, "Do as he has said, strike him down and bury him, and thus take away from me and from my father's house the guilt for the blood that Joab shed without cause. The Lord will bring back his bloody deeds on his own head, because without the knowledge of my father, he attacked and killed two men more righteous and better than himself. Abner, the son of Ner, commander of the armies of Israel, and Amasa, the son of Jether, commander of the armies of Judah. So shall their blood be come back on the head of Joab and on the head of his descendants forever. But for David and his descendants and for his house and for his throne, there shall be peace from the Lord forevermore." Then Benaiah went up and struck him down and put him to death, and he was buried in his own house in the wilderness. Do you notice where it says Joab is? Joab is beside an altar at the tent of the Lord. What a poetic place to die. See, Joab has been so guilty of shedding blood and causing all these bad things to happen. And he's going to die by an altar. His blood spilled almost like he is a sacrifice. The atonement of his death for the things that he had done. Finally, the story of Joab is over. The pain and misery that this man caused were great. And do you recall the reason that King David couldn't build the temple? 1 Chronicles chapter 22 and verse 8 says, "Because he was a man of war and shed much blood, he could not build the temple." This lesson isn't to exonerate David. No, David certainly had his faults, just like we all do. Now, he did a lot of great things, but he also had his own faults and did a lot of bad things. In times, he certainly was a warmonger, a man of war. But a lot of times, the instrument, the insinuation of that war was oftentimes Joab. The blood that Joab spilt, it says at the end of the passage that we just read that the blood may be on his hands from the house of David forevermore, removed. That this blood of Abner, this blood of Amasa, these are going to be upon Joab, not upon the house of David. He killed so many people. Joab was warring, fighting, murdering. He was the weapon in David's hand. He spilled much blood in David's name. He killed so many people, including David's own son, Absalom, who David told him, "Do not touch." I think he brought misery to David sometimes. But just like some things, and just like the guy from the beginning in the story, the boyfriend, Joab wasn't all bad. In fact, he rebukes David over the census that he takes in 2 Samuel chapter 24 and in verse 3. He says, "Why do you need to count them, David? You will have many more added unto your name. Why do you need to do this?" And it is a sin for David to number the people. God has told him not to do that. See, Joab tells him, no, this thing. This sin is because God says that people should not be numbered. Remember the boyfriend from the beginning of the story, how he would do bad things, and then right before he's about to get canned, he'd do something good, and he would redeem himself slightly to buy him more time? Joab was like that. He murdered David's sons, his friends, he caused wars, but he protected the king. You know, some people even argue that killing Absalom was Joab doing his best to defend the king, to put down the rebellion, and say that, you know, maybe killing Absalom was vindicated, even though David said he shouldn't. The thing that ties this all together from the very beginning, and the most shocking part of this all, is that Zariah was David's sister and a daughter of Jesse. Amasa was the son of Abigail, David's sister. They were all family. They were all family. And here they are, nephew killing nephew, cousin killing cousin, fighting within each other. And they're all family. This whole thing is a feud among family. Nephew killing nephew, cousin killing cousin. It's just misery. Just misery. Joab gives David some things in return, but I would say the return is largely negative on David's end. So much so that some of David's last words are to execute the man. Does that sound like someone who brought you peace or someone who brought you misery? Now let's replace Joab with some things in our lives. We each have our own misery business. Things that just seem sometimes good, but in the long run are dangerous and can hurt us. So I ask you again, what is your misery business? It could be comparison, you know. Sometimes you struggle with that. It seems nice to lift yourself up, but when you don't know all the information and you start comparing yourself to others without knowing, eventually you can hurt yourself. You can worsen your faith. It could be the music you listen to, the things we watch. There's an endless list, really, of what these things could be. Don't let it ruin things for you like it did for David. Don't leave the problem for your children or your grandchildren to face. Don't let yourself be ruined by something that's giving you less and less, but just has some good sometimes. Let's fix our business. It's time to remove our Joabs, so to speak. Let's turn to the one who redeems us from misery. Turn to the one who, instead of giving us minimum exchanges, gives us maximum value. Let go of the misery business and choose God. We have water. He has mercy. Salvation is but a step away. Come and be born in the waters of baptism and choose grace. If there's any way we can help you tonight, please come as we stand and sing the song of invitation.